Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Bill Grant, Chair of the Club's Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum and Chair of this program. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speakers for this evening's program. We have a panel of three panel members, Steve Lerner, Gail Smith, and Bradley Angel. Steve Lerner is a writer and editor who has focused on social justice issues for the past 30 years. He is the former research director at Commonweal in Bolinas, where he published a quarterly journal on environmental threats to health. He has written two books of case studies of environmental justice campaigns in communities on the fence line with heavy industries and military bases. Both were published by MIT Press. The first is entitled Diamond, A Struggle for Environmental Justice in Louisiana's Chemical Corridor. The second is Sacrifice Zones, The Front Lines of Toxic Chemical Exposure in the United States. This is for sale in the library across the, down the hall, the other end of the area. Our second speaker is Gail Smith. She lives in an impacted community south of San Francisco called Midway Village in Daly City, next to PG&E's Martin Maintenance Center. She's lived there 19 years. It's a San Mateo Housing Authority living area. She's came there disabled, and she's gotten worse health condition after living there for 19 years. The land is this land that's impacted was owned by PG&E. It was worked on by the Navy. It has a lot of toxic waste stored there, which she'll tell you about. Our third speaker is Bradley Angel. He is the Executive Director of Green Action for Health and Environmental Justice. In 1997, he joined with grassroots community environmental justice activists from California, Arizona to form Green Action. Green Action works with urban, rural, and indigenous communities in campaigns for health and environmental justice. He is a leader in the environmental health and justice movement, working with communities to stop pollution threats to health and to promote pollution prevention, clean technologies, and safe green jobs. He has played a leading role in helping communities win some of the most important struggles in the history of the environmental justice movement, including the historic fight in the late 1980s and early 1990s that stopped chemical waste management from building hazardous waste incinerator near Kettleman City, California. Bradley was one of the first environmental justice organizers helping communities in the San Joaquin Valley. He has helped co-found numerous local, statewide, and national and international environmental health and justice coalitions, including California Communities Against Toxics, the Environmental Justice Air Quality Coalition, the Indigenous Environmental Network, and the Bay Area Environmental Health Collaborative. So, Steve, you may start this.
Thank you, Bill, for inviting me to talk about this pattern of environmental justice across the country. As you mentioned, I'm returning from the front lines of toxic chemical exposure in the United States. Spent the last 7 years reporting on low-income communities where most of the residents are African-American, Latino, or Native Americans. And I'm here to report that there is a pattern in which these communities are disproportionately exposed to heavy concentrations of toxic chemicals. They live immediately adjacent to heavy industries and military bases, and chemicals from those facilities waft across the fence line or seep underneath it. And this is a toxic trespass in which the chemicals come into their community, into their homes, and into their bodies. I'd like to start just by giving you a few statistics. One is put together by a reporter named David Pace from the Associated Press. And he did a smart thing. He took the Environmental Protection Agency's toxic release inventory and overlaid demographic studies to see who lived in the communities that were closest to the places where we handle the largest volumes of toxic chemicals. What he found was that African Americans are 79% more likely than whites to live in neighborhoods where industrial air pollution is suspected of causing the greatest health danger. Latinos are twice as likely as non-Latinos to live in neighborhoods with the highest air pollution risks. A second study was done by two researchers who reviewed 16 environmental justice statistical studies between 1971 and 1992. They found, quote, "There is a clear and unequivocal class and racial bias in the distribution of environmental hazards." And then there was a third study of 368 communities in Massachusetts. And it found that low-income communities face cumulative exposures from environmentally hazardous facilities and sites that are 3 to 4 times greater than all other communities. And the authors write, quote, "Clearly not all communities in Massachusetts are polluted equally." So not only do reporters who, such as myself, who've been out in the field report this pattern of injustice, there are also numerous academic studies that show this unjust sharing of environmental burdens across the country. Now, every school child in the nation grows up learning that in the United States, all Americans are to be treated equally under the law, regardless of race, creed, or economic status. And I'm here to tell you that that's simply not happening when it comes to protecting Americans from threats posed by hotspots of pollution. If you live in an affluent white community, as these statistics demonstrate, you are much less likely to be exposed to these hazards. And since African American, Latino, and Native American populations are exposed to these elevated levels, it is not surprising to hear that they also suffer an increased incidence of environmentally induced disease and premature death. So I'd like to step back from the statistics for a minute to tell you about one of the case studies I did in Florida in a town called Tallavast, which is an African-American community that goes back to slave days. It was founded just after the Civil War when freed slaves from Virginia and North Carolina came down to an area in Florida where a turpentine camp had been set up, slashing the pines and collecting the sap and boiling it up into turpentine. And this community settled there, and over the years, a small machine shop started up across the road from them. It's a small hamlet of some 87 families. And they were happy to have some local work other than the fruit harvests and Barnum and Bailey's that was nearby and so on. Some of them were able to get jobs in the machine shop. And over the years, the machine shop grew. Cold War, when we were in the arms race with the Soviet Union, we built up our nuclear stockpiles and our weapon systems, and people in this plant built the cores of our nuclear bombs, the beryllium cores, and parts for our fighter jets. When they came home from lunch across the street to get a hot lunch, they also brought with them the beryllium dust. And this contamination not only ended up making them sick and killing a number of them, but also their loved ones who would be contaminated when they brought their clothes into the house with them. I'd like to bring it up to more recent times when Lockheed Martin bought the plant and a woman named Laura Ward was sitting in her kitchen looking out the window when she saw a crew of hard hats pull a drilling rig up onto her lawn. She ran out and confronted them and asked them what the hell they were doing. And they said, "Oh, we're drilling a test well to see if some of the toxic chemicals from Lockheed Martin have gotten into the shallow aquifer here and gotten under your house and under the house of your neighbors. And Laura Ward told me at that moment that she felt the earth shift beneath her feet. Suddenly, she started looking at her neighborhood differently. She started asking herself questions about all of the illnesses that she had noticed in the community and in her family. And she thought about the fact that there were toxic chemicals in the shallow aquifer that she was pumping her water out of. All of the homes in Tallavast depended on shallow wells. That was not true for the white community a quarter of a mile away, where they were all connected to the city water system. But it was in Tallavast. So she thought about it, and she realized that she had been pumping water that was contaminated with these trichloroethylenes up into her kitchen and into her bathroom, and cooking with it, drinking it, making baby formula with it, and bathing in it. So she got together with one of her neighbors, a woman named Wanda Washington, and together they formed an environmental justice group that began asking questions of Lockheed Martin and of the county and of the federal government. And what she found out was that there was a huge plume of this contaminated water that went under all of the homes at very high concentrations of trichloroethylene, which is a highly toxic chemical. And so together with a retired nurse in the community, she went door to door. Helen Byers Worthington went door to door and asked people about their health and put together an informal health survey which showed very high incidences of cancer, reproductive disorders, skin lesions, and a host of other health problems. I'd like to tell you that this story has a happy ending. The people of Tallavast are still there. They're involved in a lawsuit. There's some suggestion that there may be a settlement coming up out of it, but they're still there. They're no longer drinking the contaminated water, but they're living over contaminated soils. What is happening in Tallavast is happening in thousands and thousands of communities around the country where low-income people, particularly African American, Latino, and Native American people, are right next door to these hot spots of pollution. The places are industrial factories and refineries that handle large volumes of chemicals. So I could go on about these facilities that I visited. In the Sacrifice Zone book, I look at a dozen of them. One of them is a place here in the Bay Area, Daly City, which we will hear about from one of the residents in a few minutes. But I'd like to point out that the situation here in Daly City, where the San Mateo County Public Housing Complex has a facility that is located on top of contaminated soil, is not unique. Many of our subsidized housing units in this country have been built right on the fence line with heavy industry, and they put residents in a terrible dilemma where they can either leave and lose their place in public housing or stay and continue to be exposed to high level of toxins. So, I'd like to move on to talk a little bit, since I only have 5 minutes left, about what can be done about all this, because it would be too easy just to stand up here and to continue to tell stories such as the Tallavast story or the Daly City story about Americans who are in this unjust and very difficult situation. But I'd like to suggest to you that there really are practical things that we could be doing to stop building more of these sacrifice zones, because that's what's happening today. The problem is the mixture of industrial and residential neighborhoods. And this doesn't happen in affluent white communities. You don't see a refinery next to an affluent white community. It happens in low-income communities. And this is a formula for environmentally induced disease and premature death. And so I think the first thing we should do is start to look at this from a land use perspective and to say, no, we're not going to put any more residential areas right next door to our heaviest polluting industries. And then we have to do something about those that already exist. We have to create buffer zones around our industries so that we don't have residents right next door. And we have to begin to move the people who are there out of harm's way. And the corporation that is creating the problem should pay to move those people. They should buy them out or move them to another place. There are many other things we can do. We can begin to do better monitoring. There's very poor monitoring of the air and water and soil in these communities. And we can set up independently monitored places where samples are taken and analyzed to see whether the air is safe to breathe, whether the water is safe to drink, and whether the soil is safe for people to play on. We can do a better job in terms of public health. I mean, here are these areas that are next to the largest source of toxic chemicals in the country, and yet you rarely see public health officials going out there and doing surveys. It's often left up to the residents to do it themselves. And we can have better regulation of these places. Many of these places are letting out illegal levels of toxic chemicals and are getting away with it. They say it's an accident, but there's a pattern of accidents to the point where it's no longer an accident. It's just, it can be expected to happen. And when they finally are busted for letting out too many toxics, the penalty is often very low. It's a small fine, and from the perspective of these large corporations, it's a slap on the wrist, and they can continue to operate business as usual. So finally, we can begin to practice green chemistry. We can begin to substitute benign substances for toxic substances in the feedstocks we use in these industries. Green chemistry is a new field in which you analyze the way a good or service is produced, and you figure out, you use ingenuity to figure out how to reduce the toxics that we are putting out. So I suggest to you that really what this is about is it's a matter of will. It's about political will. It's about organizing people to stand up and say, no, we do not want to live in a country where this kind of injustice is allowed to stand. Thank you very much.
Thank you. That was Steve Lerner. Next is Gail Smith.
Thank you for having me. This is a first-time experience, and I'm glad that you all are here, and I hope you have patience with me. As Bill said, I'm Gail Smith, and I lived at Millway Village for 19 years. With me is Juliet Otterberry, who's lived at Millway for 28 years. Millway Village is a state of California Superfund site, and what this means is that there is chemical toxics on the site. In 1944, the federal government took soil, contaminated soil, and moved it from PG&E as fill-in at Midway Village and Bayshore Park. These chemicals are PAH, and also known as PNAs. PAH are pollutants in water, air, soil, and industrial products. PAH evaporate in the air. PAH are one of the most toxic known human carcinogens. PAH induce cancer, attacks the liver, the lungs, the skin, the blood, the eyes, the kidneys, human growth, and reproduction. At Midway Village, we have another chemical called VOCs, which migrates from underneath the soil into our apartments through the gas furnaces, the hot water heaters, the central air heating vents. We also have sewage, human feces that comes in our apartments, through our bathrooms, down the walls, down our ceilings, in our kitchen sinks. We are exposed to E. coli, salmonella, HIV, stomach cancer, lockjaw, Wells disease, bubonic plague, all from human feces. Linda Adams, the Secretary for Environmental Protection, brought together 13 environmental officials in 2006 without one Midway Village resident in this meeting. From that meeting, Linda Adams recommended to Dwayne Bay, the director of San Mateo Housing Authority, that he should meet with the residents of Midway and find programs under the HUD housing programs to relocate us. The residents were denied this. We, the residents, did the work. We found programs, a program, there are many, under the HUD and housing program. Because we are exposed to the chemicals and because no one told us about them, we felt the best program for us is the Section 8 home ownership program. This also was denied us. But Dwayne Bay sent us a letter, sent a letter to 60 households, and that's out of 150 households that live there, stating that we have options to relocate because we lived there before the major cleanup. We have not signed a toxic disclosure, and no one ever told us about these toxic chemicals. Of course, this was denied us. We have no environmental justice at Midway Village. From that meeting, Micah Dorsey, Chief Hazardous Material Division, stated, and I quote, "These people are living on a hazardous waste site, and regardless of how well it was cleaned up, there will always be concern, valid or not, from these residents about the past, present, and future health. Psychologically, this is a huge issue which many of them have not control over. If this was a wealthy community or a community that had strong political influence, I think we all know that these people would be relocated and adequately compensated." He further states, "Therefore, I think that it is important for the committee to continue to advocate for the community through the Secretary of Cal EPA to find a way to relocate them and compensate these people," unquote. We have scientists Rosemary Bowler, Wilma Subaru, and Ken Clark all state that we need to be relocated. Still no environmental justice. Why do the Midway Village residents every 5 or 10 years have a group asking our city, state, county, federal government for environmental justice? Because we're sick. 5 died in 2009. All of us right now are dealing with breathing, eye, skin, tumors, stomach cancer, breast cancer. We are protected by cement and putty. We are watching money being spent at Midway Village on paint and on windows. No relocation money. The residents are afraid of management, and they have control over the residents. We meet, we discuss, we advocate for ourselves, but we are told it's safe at Midway Village. There's no toxics there. Liar, liar, pants on fire. On January 13th, on NBC News, the Aaron Brockwich, who led one of the greatest toxic chemical environmental medical lawsuits in history, talked about she's finding cover-up in her case. Where's the environmental justice for Midway Village residents? We at the Midway Village, the residents, we call it the biggest corruption that we've ever had in our lifetime. We, the residents of Midway Village, have no environmental justice. Thank you.
Thank you, Gail. Now, Bradley Angel.
Good evening, everyone, and thank you so much for coming, and for those who are listening, thank you, too. Again, my name is Bradley Angel. I'm the executive director of an organization called Green Action for Health and Environmental Justice. And Green Action was founded in 1997, not by professional activists, but by people from low-income and communities of color and working-class communities across California, in rural communities, in urban communities, in indigenous communities from California and Arizona, came together to form Green Action because they knew that our government does not protect people of color and low-income and working-class communities, and they knew that their communities continue to be targeted and suffer. You know, every day in our country, tens of millions of school kids stand up in the morning and pledge allegiance. And in those words, in that pledge, they say there's liberty and justice for all. And in government buildings and meetings every day, as we're speaking here tonight, government officials stand and pledge allegiance to the flag and pretend that there's liberty and justice for all. But this isn't just a question of, oh, some poor people down in Midway Village in Daly City are suffering and, oh, isn't that bad. This is a situation where the laws of the land, as weak as they are not being followed. And it's not just like somebody forgot that there's a law against racial discrimination. This is intentional. It is in full knowledge. And why do I say that? Gail just talked very movingly about the problems in Midway. And Green Action's had the privilege of working with folks in Midway for many years. About 10 years ago, Keith Takata, who at that time and for many years was the chief of the Superfund division for the United States so-called Environmental Protection Agency, who we finally got to come out to Midway, admitted that under Gail's house and under other residents' house, who, and keep in mind, these folks cannot afford to move, so they are prisoners of poverty and of racism and injustice, Mr. Takata of the US EPA admitted straight out publicly that they knew, the state and the federal government was well aware, that the people of Midway Village, at least those living in the low-lying parts, were living on top of Superfund levels of toxic waste. Now, and I asked him, Mr. Takata, would you, as a U.S. EPA official, let your kids live on top of toxic waste? Would you trust the government when they said the foundations of your house will protect you? No way. No how. Would the heads of PG&E, whose toxic waste it is, let their kids and families live on top of the Superfund levels that are known to be present? This isn't just an allegation from the community. I mean, the government admits that there's Superfund levels of toxic waste remaining under people's homes. It is a crime, in our opinion. It is a sacrifice zone. What I'd like to talk about, give some other examples. Again, this isn't just some, we have situations like Midway where folks were moved on top of toxic waste that was known to be there, in, as far as we can tell. But we also have across the country, and when we, this program's called Sacrifice Zones in Environmental Justice, not just, oops, somebody moved on top of toxic waste. The work that Green Action does and others around this country in the environmental justice movement clearly has shown that there is the specific targeting of low-income and communities of color for projects that nobody in their right mind, particularly those proposing them, like in government and industry, would ever want in their rich and gated communities. And that's why we see not only the disproportionate location of, for example, hazardous waste dumps or garbage incinerators in low-income communities of color, but the actual targeting, the specific targeting. I've been doing this work for almost 25 years now, and I've worked in hundreds of communities. And when I first started doing this work, I was really educated when a colleague who works in communities in Southern California, shall we say, liberated from an industry conference, something called the Sorrell Report. And the Sorrell Report was paid for with our tax dollars, done by Sorrell and Associates, a consulting firm, I think it was for the Integrated Waste Management Board. And it was basically talking about the, quote, unquote, political difficulties of siting garbage incinerators. Well, heck yeah, who wants a garbage incinerator trucking in garbage from all over and emitting deadly dioxin, toxic metals, particulates, and a host of other pollutants in their community? And this study, paid for with government dollars, was a guidebook of... Now, it didn't come out and say, oh, yeah, dump it in poor communities of color, but it pretty much said that. It did a demographic analysis of the community seen as most likely to resist and least likely to resist. And, of course, those deemed by industry and government as least likely to resist were poor, people struggling to make a living, busy to have the time to find out what's being proposed by some waste company. But it doesn't end there. About 20 years ago, the U.S. government was trying to figure out, what do we do with all the nuclear fuel rods we have at all the nuclear power plants? Did they propose to put it in Beverly Hills or Atherton or some other rich white community? Of course not. Our government, with our tax dollars, through the Department of Energy, sent out a letter to every Indian tribe in the United States offering them untold riches. Tens and tens of millions of dollars. If all they would do is take the high-level nuclear fuel rods for, 40 years. In other words, you're poor, you have no economic development, we'll make you rich beyond your wildest dreams, and all you have to do is become a sacrifice zone. Take America's high-level nuclear waste. And there were raging battles in a number of desperate tribes. And from our perspective, thank goodness, the wisdom of indigenous people prevailed, often through the efforts of tribal members, and that was rejected. But it was a conscious effort by our government. In California, you hear around the country some people think California is, so liberal and environmental. I would beg to differ. We have three commercial hazardous waste landfills in the state of California. Guess where they're located? Three out of three, what a coincidence or not, are all located, 100% of the hazardous waste landfills in California, all of them are in low-income, Spanish-speaking, predominantly farm worker communities. And from my experience working with all of them, none of them, the people in the community, knew what was being proposed when the waste facilities moved in. In California, we have three garbage incinerators. Guess where they're located? pretty much the same, not farmer communities, low-income communities of color. We, in California, we had a giant medical waste incinerator. It had hundreds of violations. If you were a kid in that neighborhood of East Oakland, a low-income community of color, and had three serious crimes, you'd be locked up and sent to jail for the rest of your life. If you were IES, the medical waste incinerator company, in cahoots with the state of California, you could have 287 violations and still get a permit. And when the deputy assistant second-in-command at the Bay Area Air District finally decided they had to deny their renewal permit, he was called into his boss's office, where his boss and the U.S. EPA told him, you cannot deny that permit. He said, wait, we're not allowed to. Our own laws say you got to deny it. They said, issue it. It would be a terrible precedent. And that community was seen as a sacrifice zone. Thank goodness, Green Action and the community organized, and we shut it down. And we advocated for cleaner solutions for treating medical waste, such as well-operated sterilization equipment. And we see the same pattern everywhere. Before the meeting tonight, one of the folks here mentioned many years ago that he had heard I had been involved in a battle in Arizona. And just very briefly, when the state of Arizona in 1989 wanted to build a facility allegedly for Arizona's waste, they actually let this giant company with state and federal approval to start building a giant facility with three incinerators, seven landfills. But where did they pick? A rich Scottsdale, Arizona? No, not that we would want it there either. They picked Mobile, Arizona, a little town in the desert that was founded many years earlier, like 100 years earlier, by freed slaves from Mobile, Alabama, who broke down in the desert. That's where they wanted to pick. Oh, yeah, it's really great. Let's put it where poor people of color and a bunch of desert rats live. And just they let them start building it before there was even a public hearing. Thank goodness people from all cultures in Arizona rose up and stopped it. And they had to dismantle the plant. I want to just take a few minutes and talk about another sacrifice zone here in California, which is at this point, you know, one of the highest profile such cases, situations in the United States. And it's also one of the many birthplaces of the environmental justice movement. It's 3.5 hours south of San Francisco, halfway between San Francisco and Los Angeles, along the Interstate 5. It's a little town called Kettleman City, and I've had the privilege of working there for 24 years. And I first started working in Kettleman City in the 80s when Chemical Waste Management, which already operated a giant toxic waste dump there, the biggest one in the West, secretly tried to build a hazardous waste incinerator there with the approval of state, federal, and county agencies. And there was a great battle, and that was defeated through organizing, huge movement of groups across this country, and legal support. And but today, and for the last number of years, Chemical Waste Management, with the support of our government, despite years of violations of our country's hazardous waste laws, including illegal disposal, toxic spills, failure to do required monitoring for years, is trying to get an even bigger toxic waste dump. But, you know, the way I think the government looks at it, you know, it's just a bunch of poor brown people. Now, they'll never say that. However, they go to court and fight the community who's demanding to have some of the information in Spanish. When they had the hearing a little over a year ago, if you were a white guy, you got 5 minutes to speak. But if you were Spanish-speaking Latino, like most people in Kettleman City are, you got 2.5 minutes to speak. I thought in the United States of America we had something called civil rights laws. At least I was taught that. Last I checked, those laws are still on the books. California Government Code 11135 and Title VI of the United States Civil Rights Act. But apparently, as we are hearing from our government, through their actions, those laws are meaningless. I don't think they are. I think that's what people fought and died for in our country. And, you know, we just celebrated Martin Luther King's birthday, and Martin Luther King Jr. and so many others died for these civil rights laws. Yet in Kettleman City and in so many other communities, if you're poor, you're brown, and you speak Spanish, you get 2.5 minutes to testify at a hearing about a toxic dump in your community. And if you're a white guy from the company or anywhere else, you get 5 minutes. That's racism, And that's the tools they use to create these sacrifice zones. Right now, chemical waste management is running out of space at the largest toxic waste dump in the western United States. Government is in crisis. Industry is freaking out. What are we going to do if Chem Waste can't get their permits to expand? And there is a little problem. In their minds, a huge one in the community's mind, in my mind, the government always said everything was fine in Kettleman City. The health of the people was fine. We knew it was false. And Green Action and the community group El Pueblo, People for Clean Air and Water, and the youth group Kids Protecting Our Planet, back in 2007 decided we're going to go door to door and we're going to do a good health survey. It's not going to ask people about the toxic waste dump. It's going to be really confidential, ask them about their health. And as we were doing this, we realized that there was an enormous problem beyond what we ever had nightmares about. And it was that there was a lot of babies being born with birth defects in a small period of time and a lot of babies dying. And the government refused to investigate. The county health officers stood up and said, give them their permit. We don't need to investigate. The state agencies mandated to investigate these things. The State Department of Public Health refused to investigate. But we know how to organize, so at least we forced the governor, Schwarzenegger, to order an investigation. But we demanded an independent one because we didn't trust these state agencies. But Schwarzenegger basically had the state investigate themselves. And as people may know, they just came out and said, oh, well, you know, it's probably not the toxic dump, and it's probably not the pesticides right next to the fields. And, oh, yeah, it's probably not the contaminated water that exceeds safe drinking water levels. And, oh, it couldn't possibly be the diesel emissions. And we don't know what it is. And so, therefore, and, you know, they even recommended reducing pollution. But what are they doing? They're trying to expand the toxic waste dump. A few weeks ago, the Valley Air District approved a permit for a 600-megawatt fossil fuel power plant a few miles away. There's plans to start dumping sewage sludge, toxic and bacteria-infested sewage sludge, right next to people's homes on the fields. The pesticide spraying is continuing. The diesel pollution is continuing. And as we speak, people in Kettleman City continue to drink poison water, even though their community is suffering dying babies and birth defects. It's a sacrifice zone. But it's racism. It's injustice. It's a, and the laws of our land are not being followed. So, and I think it's a really horrifying example of here we are, even under a presidential administration that's pledged to uphold environmental justice, but they're not. I will say that the U.S. EPA in San Francisco has done a few things that hadn't been done earlier. For example, cracking down on violations at Chem Waste in Kettleman City. We appreciate that. However, the U.S. EPA had pledged, for example, to finally start processing and making rulings on civil rights violations, civil rights complaints. In 1994, which I believe was 17 years ago, people in Kettleman City filed a civil right, and Button, Willow, and Westmoreland, the three toxic dump communities, filed a civil rights complaint against the state of California saying that the fact that all three toxic dumps in California are in Latino, farmworker, Spanish-speaking communities is illegal under federal civil rights laws. 17 years later, despite promises of the Obama administration to finally rule on that, which is, should be an open and shut case, they still haven't. Last June, more civil rights complaints were filed with the government claiming that, and I think correctly so, that when Kings County gave the Latino Spanish speakers 2.5 minutes to speak, but the white guys 5 minutes, that violates our laws. The state attorney general, who is now our governor, Jerry Brown, and the Obama EPA and Department of Justice and Department of Transportation have failed to act on these civil rights complaints, improperly sitting on them. And the people continue to be dumped on. And this is the situation we have of sacrifice zones, and this is why everybody needs to wake up, because the pollution doesn't end at their communities. And we cannot allow our school kids, when they stand up in the morning and pledge allegiance and say liberty and justice for all, for those words not to have to ring true. But I hate to say they're not. Thank you.
Thank you, Bradley. Now, if all three speakers would come here to the table, we can take questions from the audience.
was wondering, how do you feel about Yucca Mountain?
Yucca Mountain is, I think it's also, for those who don't know, Yucca Mountain is in Nevada, and it's on Western Shoshone indigenous traditional lands, which actually by treaty was supposed to go to the Shoshone tribe. And it was the place that the U.S. government picked to put permanently the nuclear fuel rods that they tried to dump for 40 years on every tribe in the country, or one of those tribes, if they were suckers enough. I think that would have been another sacrifice zone. You know, government studies showed that the alleged safety was questionable, and there was real, I think, scientific questions raised about the safety of that site. I don't think we can, you know, we have to deal with the nuclear fuel rods we have, and that's a real serious issue. I'm glad the Yucca Mountain Project, at least for now, has been defeated, but we do have to deal with the existing waste. But at the same time, we have to make sure that we're not creating more more waste. And do you want to just expand on your question? I mean, I would, you know, and again, if I just say that, the issue of what do we do with the fuel rods that are there, what shouldn't happen with them is basically bribe Indian tribes or other poor communities to take it. As society, we need to take responsibility and figure out, you know, one of the most challenging engineering and scientific questions, but it shouldn't be, oh, yeah, put it on some tribal lands and just a bunch of indigenous people and it's a sacrifice zone. That's not a solution. And it's going to come back to haunt everybody. So it's a high priority for figuring out, and there are no easy answers. But we say here at Green Action, don't just go and dump it on the most vulnerable parts of our society.
I've got a question. What are the most common illnesses around these sacrifice zones? And also, how successful are people at linking the sacrifice zone pollution to the diseases?
I'll just say quickly, and Steve, you might want to answer. I think it's very difficult with both limited scientific know-how and medical know-how and also the lack of political will. In Kettleman City, as I mentioned, you have a wide range, very high rate, unusual rate of birth defects, which the government first tried denying and had to eat their words. You have asthma. You have childhood cancer in the area. You have infant deaths, which they didn't even look at. In Midway Village, it's one of the only places where perfectly normal folks go around showing perfect strangers lifting their shirts, you know, wow, look at these rashes all over my body. And yet government's like, well, gee, I can't figure out what's wrong. Well, let's see. Let's look at what toxics people living on top of, what toxics the kids played on the playground, which was on top of toxic waste, where the daycare center was. And maybe you might be able to link the two. But, you know, if you don't look and you don't use your brain in the science, you're not going to find. In Kettleman City, they refuse and continue to refuse to do biomonitoring, test the people's bodies, because I think they're afraid of what they're going to find.
Well, at Midway Village, we are given, not I, but all the people who are moving in there now are signing a toxic disclosure. Right on it, it says cause cancer, these chemicals. When we talk to our fishers and tell them what is going on with us, our symptoms, we're told that they don't want to hear it. I was told that by the supervisor's office, our representative, Adrian Tashir. Her representative says if we didn't get on the waiting list, now you give me a letter saying I can be relocated because I'm exposed to these chemicals, but then you deny that and tell me I have to get on a waiting list to get out of this toxic environment. That's not relocation. So they're told if we don't get on a waiting list and then you get on the waiting list or you apply for the waiting list, then it turns into a lottery. And then it says you're not selected. So all these different words are totally different. We will never be relocated. Now the forest is we they're going to give everybody at Midway Village Section 8 vouchers. But you have two groups of people there. You have a group of people that's very sick, who's been there the longest, who's been totally exposed to chemicals with all these disease and symptoms. And then you're all of a sudden they come and we ask for relocation with Section 8 homeownership. This is denied. Then all of a sudden they turn around and say they're going to give us Section 8 vouchers. But they have to apply to get that because they're going to Washington, when at one point Section 8 vouchers was falling out of the sky to residents who weren't talking and who were making noise about relocation. So right back to what we've been saying, it's we're being held hostages, bottom line. Because, we wouldn't be there if we could afford to get out of there.
Right.
And as Bradley's saying, these chemicals are underneath the building. We have cement blocks in our floors. You can see the pipe prints in the cement floors. So being a little common person, not knowing anything, some of us start to put two and two together. These chemicals are eating up the pipes. Why is sewage going into my kitchen sink? Why is the bathroom in the kitchen sink connected? Because the chemicals are eating up the pipes.
I think one of the things Gail is pointing out is the difficulty of making a case. And it's not just residents who live in these sacrifice zones who have trouble making the case. It's also the lawyers. And, it's notoriously difficult to prove that the release of a toxic chemical at plant A is causing a cancer in residence B. And the burden of proof is always on the victim and not on the person who's letting out the toxic chemical. So we really have to change our laws surrounding this. There are a lot of things that have to be changed. We have to get more uniform laws about which toxic chemicals should be controlled and to what extent, because the laws are not consistent across the country. But we also need a common sense part of this legal process in which if you can make a prima facie case that people in an area adjacent to a facility that is handling large amounts of a toxic chemical are falling ill with symptoms that are consistent with exposure to that toxic chemical, at that point the burden of proof should shift, and it should no longer be the people on the receiving end of the chemicals who need to prove that they are being poisoned, but rather it is the corporation that needs to prove that they are not poisoning the residents. So there are a lot of things that we could do if there was the political will to move this issue. And that brings me to another piece of this, which I think is worth talking about. And that is the fact that the environmental movement has been sorely inadequate in dealing with these hot spots of pollution in low-income communities, where there are large numbers of residents who are African American, Latino, and Native American. And I would suggest that if the environmental movement wants to regain momentum and expand the tent, that they should put energy into reaching out to the grassroots groups that are described in this book and others like them around the country. Reach out to Gail and other groups of people in these sacrifice zones who are organizing and provide them with the resources that they have, the technological, the scientific resources, the money, the expertise, and the organizing skills. And Bradley has been doing that for 25 years, but if you look at the top 10 environmental groups around the country, they are largely missing in action in this. And I think also we have to go beyond just talking with environmentalists about this problem. This is a civil rights problem. And civil rights groups have not been at the forefront of this fight. And I think they should begin to look at this and say, no, this is an ongoing form of discrimination, and it should be an important part of our agenda to make people aware that this kind of racial environmental discrimination continues to take place. I think we should bring in the labor movement. There is often a division between the people who work at these plants and the people who live in these communities. People who work at the plants want to make sure that the jobs continue. The people who live in the communities are on the receiving end of these toxic chemicals 24 hours a day. Really, they should be making common cause to make a safer work environment and a safer residential environment.
Thank you. Bradley, do you have any closing statement to make?
The encouraging thing, you know, as we, because it's easy to get discouraged when, you know, the folks in Midway Village continue to suffer night and day, or, you know, every day as we speak here tonight in Kettleman City, the mothers who gave birth to kids with birth defects and several who lost their babies continue to drink contaminated water and our government does nothing. It's easy to get pretty depressed. The good news is that in communities across this country, communities are finding out what's going on, are linking up. There is a growing, at least, environmental justice movement, and victories have been won. You know, here in San Francisco, no thanks to the big environmental groups or our government, but the dirty PG&E power plant in Hunters Point was shut down after years of ferocious struggle. You know, years ago in Kettleman City, the giant incinerator that was attempted to be rammed down their throats was defeated. David did defeat Goliath, and it's possible. But I think that, and what Green Action works to do, is not only help specific communities and bring diverse communities together, but also to bring in new allies. Tomorrow we'll be in Salinas, where the government's trying to push an incinerator in a poor farm worker community. And we'll be working with labor and other community members to fight that and try to work for good solutions. So there's hope, and victories are being won, but we have to get justice in Midway Village and in Kettleman City and so many others. And we hope everybody listening will join in some way.
Thank you. And Gail, do you have any closing statement?
Yes. I would like to say that in my community, as I've been working with the residents, I find that there's a lot of residents that have been living in low-income housing all their lives. We are held hostage. It is civil rights because management, when they say, I live there, I just heard from a resident who's in a domestic violence situation. Her partner is being, broke a window. She's been charged $800 to restore this window, but it's a domestic violence situation. So the management wrote a letter for her to sign. If she don't pay for the $800 window, she could not take advantage of a Section 8 voucher that she may not ever get. So the management in these places have no compassion on people like me. I suggested to my management and my housing director, come live at Midway Village. The director said no. He wouldn't let his mother live there because there's too many problems there. The management need to be made to live there because we did a newspaper article. They put it in the office saying a picture of the resident that was in there saying, liar, liar, it's no chemicals here. These are things that should be against the law. Our government money, HUD tells me, we give Midway Village the money. They have sole entity to decide what to do with it, what to do with my life. This is wrong. They have their lawyers. We The poor people have no lawyers. There's not a lawyer in America that I have talked to will come and help us. That should not be. How are you going to sit over here and know you have lawyers? In fact, the director told me I cannot be relocated unless I file a lawsuit. The present director told me we cannot get relocation unless we have a court order. So why are they playing games with us? We're already sick. The chemicals not only affect us physically, it affects us mentally. There are so many sick residents at Midway Village. I tell them, we have one meeting every month. I said, I'm going to get some beds in there and call some doctors to help us, to examine us, because we say crazy things to each other, so we know something is wrong. But we need help. We need someone in the United States, in California, to advocate for us. It's ridiculous for us to live and pay our rent, no matter where it comes from, each month. 19 years of rent, 40 years of rent, and we are still treated like this? It's terrible. So, you know, I hope you guys hear us and, you know, let's talk, let's help one another. Because we, just because we have low income does not mean that we should be treated the way we are being treated. Right. I thank you for listening to me.
Thank you. Steve, did you have a last word?
No, I think Gail has summed it up pretty well.
Okay. Our thanks to our distinguished panelists tonight of Steve Lerner, Gail Smith, and Bradley Angel. And now this program of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 107th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.